I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very happy to have with me today Professor Anthony Frendel, who is head of the Department of Oriental Studies here at the University of Malta. He's a professor of Near Eastern Archaeology and the Hebrew Bible. He's also a member of the Department of Classics and Archaeology, which is where I have had the pleasure of knowing him best. Professor Frendel's research interests include Near Eastern archaeology, with a focus on the emergence of ancient Israel as evidenced in the Hebrew Bible and Syro-Palestinian archaeology, Northwest Semitic languages, with a focus on classical Hebrew and Phoenician Punic, Bible studies, mainly the Hebrew Bible, Phoenician Punic inscriptions from the Maltese Islands, especially those retrieved from the wonderful site of Tassilch, where he was co-director of excavations from 96 to 99. He's currently finishing a book on a methodological study of the relationship between text and artifact, with special reference to pre-exilic Israel. That's if he's allowed the time to finish that off. However, today Professor Frendel is here in his new guise as co-director of the Confucius Institute at the University of Malta, and he'll be telling us all about this new and exciting venture. Welcome, Professor Frendel.
Thank you very much.
Firstly, as obviously in the introduction will have shown, you're known as a Near Eastern scholar, but here we're talking about the Far East. Has Chinese culture always been of interest to you, or is it something that you're discovering as you go along in your new appointment as co-director?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. I think it all really came about when the university decided to introduce Chinese at the university, and when Rector signed agreements with China on the Confucius Institute, about which we'll talk later on. It became apparent to that if Chinese has to be introduced at the university level, the best bet will be to link it somehow or other with the Department of Oriental Studies. And that was really coincidental, because our department had changed its name from Department of Arabic and Near Eastern Studies to that of Oriental Studies for academic and logistic reasons. And it came really apt at the same time, because the Orient is the Orient, and it includes both the Near, the Middle, and the Far East. So when that happened, I was appointed co-director together with Dr. Wang of the Confucius Institute, and the idea was that when any academic program is introduced, it will pass through the obvious place. Any academic program on Chinese at this university will be offered by, let's say, the Confucius Institute, but it will pass through the Department of Oriental Studies at the Faculty of Arts. And having done that, I really got hooked on this, because I started seeing parallels between my own area, which is the Near East, in various things, like, for example, the writing systems. And now I was told recently I was in Oxford on a research visit, and I was told that the latest research shows that even archaeologically there is, in antiquity, really in antiquity, far, far, thousands of years ago, there were links between the Far East, China, and the Near East. So, and the Middle East. So that's really getting me, that's how I'm getting into it.
Well, certainly it's a fascinating area, and perhaps later on we'll be able to talk about your visit there in a little bit more detail. Perhaps you could explain what exactly a Confucius Institute is.
Exactly. Now, when China adopted what in its English version it calls the opening up policy, which is its own version of glasnost and perestroika, it immediately, obviously, was extremely interested in fostering links with the West. And this happened at the same pari passu with China's economic development. And in order to foster such ideals, One of the things which the Chinese honestly believe in, and I think they are correct, is that there has to be cultural exchange between different nations for there to be mutual understanding on a global level. And so they came up with this idea of establishing what they call Confucius Institutes all over the world. What is a Confucius Institute? A Confucius Institute is an institute which is largely, if not wholly, financed by China. And the idea is to introduce the teaching of Chinese language and culture, or to foster it, if it already exists there, in various countries of the world. Now, in Malta, there was no study of Chinese at university level. And when last year the university opted to introduce this, there was immediately the idea of signing up an agreement with China to set up a Confucius Institute at the University of Malta. So the official name is Confucius Institute at the University of Malta, or let's say Confucius Institute at the University of Bangor or whatever. Now, the idea is to introduce and or enhance the teaching of Chinese language and culture. To do this at various levels. Now, there are over 500, if not more, Confucius Institutes all over the world. For example, in Great Britain alone, there are 12. In Italy, there are 3. In Malta, obviously, there is 1. And various works are done. For example, there is academic and non-academic, there are academic and non-academic programs. So, for example, non-academic programs would mean organizing language and culture programs to the community at large, similar to what the Chinese Cultural Institute in Malta does, but a bit on a more closer to university level type. That is the basic aim. Now, if you want to ask me about the setup, I can tell you that. Well, the setup of a Confucius Institute is as follows. When, let's say, a Confucius Institute is set up, let us take our own case, the University of Malta and China. So when Rector went off to China last year to sign the relative agreements, in fact, 2 documents were signed. One of them was with what is known as Hanban. Hanban being a Chinese word meaning the, let's say, Office of Chinese Language. This is in simple English, it is the headquarters of this idea of fostering Chinese language and culture.
Yes, I came across this in my researches on the internet.
And the headquarters obviously are in Beijing. And that's one agreement. But the agreement stipulates that every Confucius Institute has got to have a partner institution. Now, since the University of Malta happens to be a university, therefore the partner institution has to be a university. And the partner University of Malta is a wonderful university, one of the top 20 in China out of over 3,000 universities, by the way, so top 20 meaning pretty good, is Xiamen University, which is in the south of China. And as you may recall, recently, Xiamen University provided Malta, the university, and Malta at large, with a wonderful artistic performance, which was held about 2 months ago.
Extremely popular.
And it was very wonderful. I mean, it was interesting. So that is what we try to do.
But the Confucius Institutes then are not all connected with the universities, but...
no, but somehow. Largely, yes.
Largely, mm-hmm.
Largely, yes. Let me try and think of examples where they are not with universities. I can't think of actually. The vast majority are linked with universities.
That was the impression I got from
reading. For example, tell you that there are Confucius Institute links with the University of Rome, La Sapienza, with the University of Turin, with the University of Pisa, with the University of, in Wales, the chief university, Lampeter, and another one in Wales, one in Edinburgh. All these are
and
universities.
And these institutes, do they have always the same aims? Or, for example, I just happened to be looking at some examples in England, and there was the London School of Economics and Political Science. Mm-hmm. They also have a Confucius Institute, which is perhaps more on business studies, or yes. There was the Aalborg University, which was called the Innovation and something else, I can't remember the name right now. Yeah. So do they have Confucius Institutes with different slants?
Yes, but those specialized aims are the exception. England is way ahead on Chinese studies, way ahead. And it's so far ahead that it has already introduced Chinese in schools also at GCSE level, and obviously universities, which it always had. And for example, I can tell you that in London there is one Confucius Institute specialized only on medicine, another one on business, as you say. But those are exceptions.
Where the links have become quite sophisticated.
Yeah, exactly. Links. Usually, Confucius Institutes aim to remain at a more general level in the sense of offering specialized courses in Chinese language and culture. Having said that, we forgot one important aim, even for Malta. One of the aims, which is perhaps not always so clearly spelled out, and I'm trying to work very hard on this, is to foster links, to activate links with the partner university. In our case, it means with Xiamen University, which, as I said, is one of the top universities in China.
Is this a generalist university? Or
General university, general yes. University. But it's gone, obviously, it's got its own strong points and so on. Many faculties, like, you know, engineering, medicine, etc. Thousands of students, lots of foreign students also and so on. Wonderful place, by the way, also. Now, in fact, recently, I sent an email through your office with your kind assistance to all heads, deans, coordinators and directors of institutes, so that if anybody is interested to foster links in their own area with Xiamen University, they can talk to me, and then I talk to Dr. Wang, and we see what can be done about it. To the moment, I already have about 4 or 5 people who answered, including something very important, medicine. Oh. And so, you know, we'll work on that.
That's a wonderful idea. Yeah. I mean, it would certainly enrich our university experience if we could develop those.
And the Confucius Institute is ready to offer, for example, I shall make this very clear to people concerned when they come and talk to me about it. The Confucius Institute will offer, through the headquarters in China and through the partner universities, people who come and lecture here for a certain time. And we already have for October, that is on a small scale thing, next October, we have one of the so-called volunteers. Yes, because there's another thing I want to say. Perhaps I'm not letting you ask. You ask me a question because I'm talking too much.
No, carry on.
No, because the setup is as follows. The institute, again, let's take our own case. The contract stipulates that there will be 2 directors, one Chinese director, in our case, Dr. Ying Wang, and a Maltese director, in our case, it's I. And now, Dr. Wang happens to be specialized in the teaching of Chinese as a foreign language, which is ideal. But she obviously has got a lot of administrative work. So what Hanban does, Hanban is this word which you have to remember, headquarters of Chinese language, they send what they call teachers and volunteers. What are these? Teachers would be lecturers or assistant lecturers or professors, depending on the case, whose job is to teach Chinese, and they're obviously paid a salary for it by their own country. The volunteers, on the contrary, will be people who are specialized, usually at MA level, so there'll be assistant lecturers, who want to come and experience teaching Chinese in one of the CIs, who will obviously be given a certain amount of backup money by their institution, but they're not on a normal salary. That's why they're called volunteers. And we already have, in Malta, 3 volunteers.
Gosh. And what are they doing exactly?
They're helping up in the setup, and they're already teaching. 2 of them are teaching Two of them are already teaching degree plus courses in Chinese, and one of them will be teaching some Chinese, which we're going to offer to the public in general. And in October, he will be offering a course on business and economy in China to the FEMA faculty.
And in fact, this was one of the things that interested me as I was sort of doing the reading for in preparation for this interview. The idea of learning Mandarin Chinese obviously has taken off in these last years because there is a lot of an emphasis on the booming economy in China, and therefore an interest, an awakened interest in the country in general, and also what access people better access one could get by learning Chinese. But in our case, since they're linking it to the university, you're not going to be talking about just language as a tool for moving on. I mean, language, you don't have to be a philosopher of language to realize that even learning a language, you're going to be taking on the culture of the country. Here at our Confucius Institute, how are we going to be actually developing that idea of not just language as a tool, but language as an entry point to Chinese culture in general?
Very interesting question. You've actually touched a point which I've always tried, together with my colleagues in the Department of Oriental Studies, to practice in the other languages which we teach, which are mainly Arabic, Hebrew, and some Finnish and Punic. The idea, the philosophy is, first of all, the Confucius Institute will be offering two different sets of courses. Some are academic and therefore at university level, and I come to that in order to answer your question. Others are courses for the general public where no diploma or degree is involved. Now, when it comes to the academic programs, my department has always insisted that there has to be a ratio of how many hours of language are taught vis-a-vis of how many hours of culture are taught. And the ratio is always 2-1. For every 2 hours which they see a lecturer in class for language, they see him or her 1 hour for the culture. The idea being is twofold, two ideas. One is that culture is obviously extremely important, and if one thinks carefully about it, language itself is already a part of culture. The second idea is that obviously the language learning is more difficult than the culture learning, so this explains the ratio of 2-1. Now, I have insisted and discussed this at length with Dr. Wang, and she saw it and she agreed that when we built the Chinese academic programs, they have to be built on the pattern of the Department of Oriental Studies. Now, what will our first step be? Because these things take a lot of time. Our first step is that we've already worked the program for a diploma course in Chinese, which will soon hopefully be approved by Senate. All the documents practically are in. And the diploma course will be a part-time, two-year evening diploma course in Chinese. And obviously, successful candidates will be awarded a diploma by the University of Malta. Once that kicks off, we shall start working on something which is more substantial, to build up a program of a BA in Chinese, both general and honors. Now, to answer your question directly, although we'll be teaching Mandarin and mainly modern Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, there will be cultural courses involved, historical courses, perhaps some anthropology and archaeological courses, why not? And we have to lead our students to be fascinated also with the culture in its own right, because ultimately, despite the economic initiative which many governments saw through and wanted, there is the culture in its own right. And at the end of the day, as a person of the Faculty of Arts, I have a bit to defend our own position here. At the end of the day, this is a humanities subject which is studied for its own sake, for the love of the thing, and then can be employed on many things. I just would like to point out one thing. Governments should know, I mean, worldwide, that in World War II, had it not been for the people they recruited from top universities, people who are specialized in ancient strange languages like ancient Hebrew, ancient Akkadian, ancient Assyrian, ancient Chinese, those were the people who helped governments, because of their training, to decode German, ciphers and so on. So, I mean, but that's an application, it's not the motive.
Perhaps also looking at some of the articles I read in the New York Times and some comments underneath some articles from various newspapers and journals, Mandarin Chinese is difficult. For Westerners, we're not talking a Romance language which is going to be familiar to anybody. One shouldn't get carried away with the idea of a short course in Chinese.
Being able to sort of speak your way at
a business interview. It's just not going to happen, really?
I agree completely with you. I mean, I'm not my Chinese is not my field, but I've read something about it. I've seen parallels with the ancient languages which I've done in the Near East. And it is no joke. Although modern Mandarin Chinese has been simplified as far as the writing system goes since the time of Mao Zedong, and therefore the characters have been reduced. Let's put it this way. In order to read a newspaper comfortably, one has got to learn 3,000 characters. But that shouldn't put deject one, because it's a completely different system. And I know something about it, because I've read something about it, and I've seen parallels to what I've done in the Near East. So you've got a mixture of, for example, in the writing system, pictograms, with a mixture of ideograms, with a mixture of syllabic things. And therefore, what is a negative thing can become a positive one. So, for example, if you say Beijing, you write two characters only. In English, you need seven characters, let's face it. And when you say Bei, you're meaning north. And when you say Jing, you're meaning south. So you say Nanjing, then you mean the southern capital, and so on and so forth. So it's a puzzle. Obviously, one has got to apply oneself. But at the end of the day, I think it would be fascinating, and I want to dip into it a bit myself if I have time. And strangely enough, I've seen parallels between the writing system of Chinese, especially of old Chinese, but even modern in a sense, and, let's say, a language of the Near East known as Akkadian. And I've checked with experts on this, and because I attended lectures in China on this, and I said, this is the same. So, except obviously for the visible part, where the figures are a bit different. But the principle is the same. So I queried and I asked, could there have been? Because the earliest evidence of Chinese characters date to about 1,000 years later than the earliest one in the Near East. So I was wondering whether there was a link there. And given this new idea which we have from archaeology that there was a link between China and what it calls the West, the Near East would be West for it, already in antiquity, perhaps the idea was carried over. I mean, I'm not saying that, because otherwise I would perhaps remove the joy of the Chinese of their language being so old. But I mean, there's something there. And there is a parallelism which makes it fascinating.
And another point I think that it's important to make is, when you're speaking China, you look at the map and you see this rather large red country, and it seems rather monolithic. But of course, you're talking northern China, western China,
and
you've central, about completely
different 20 different ethnic groups.
Exactly. So that in itself,
with different dialects. If a Chinese were to speak, well, the standard Chinese is Mandarin, but a person from the south would speak, for example, Cantonese. And they wouldn't be able to completely understand each other. They wouldn't. But obviously, there is a thing called standard Chinese, which every boy and girl learns at school, which is Mandarin. Mm-hmm. But that's one of many dialects.
And even the cultural mores of the areas.
Of course.
There must be huge differences.
And even physically they appear to be different. I've seen people in the south, I've seen people in the further north, and But it's a fascinating country, by the way. I've been there once.
Yes, tell us about your trip.
It's a fascinating country. First of all, China is extremely developed from on the technological, architectural point of view. Well, first of all, the first thing, if you enter the Beijing airport, you will be taken aback with the majesty of this place, which they refurbished and redid and rebuilt, in a sense, for the Olympics. Mm. Everything is massive.
Yes.
And they're also very hospitable people, extremely hospitable. And they've got their own rights, R-I-T-E-S. tea is a right, the way you prepare your tea. It's a fact. We need to learn this culture. And I'm in my old age, if I may say so, I'm extremely fascinated by it. And one thing which I would love to do perhaps one day, when I perhaps be a bit more quieter on the administrative side, is to see these parallels between the Near Middle East and the Far East.
And before we go, unfortunately, running out of time, a little word about Confucius himself.
Yes, Confucius.
Presumably
yes.
They've chosen Confucius Institute as the name because Confucius is the Chinese, because he had an original name in Chinese. But at least it's a name that's known worldwide has a very good reputation.
Because yes, he's what we would call a wise man, you know, in those days, wise men bordering on religious, ethical man who handed over principles which would resemble, for example, things like we have in the Hebrew Bible in the book of Proverbs, which are wise sayings, which are also ethical sayings and so on, and sometimes wise observations on life, a philosopher if you want, who happens to have lived in the same period like Plato in the West, an interesting timeline. And one conference which I attended, somebody quoted a saying of his which is very interesting. To this effect, the problem is not that you go slow, but the problem is if you stop. So that will give me some impetus to keep moving despite the difficulties.
And with that quotation from Confucius, this brings this interview to an end. Thank you very much, Professor Anthony Frendo.
Xixie, as our Chinese friends would say, Xixie. Thank you.
I do hope you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.